Hurricane Irene has come ashore in North Carolina as the storm makes its way up the Atlantic coast, and hundreds of thousands of people who live in the hurricane's path have been evacuated from North Carolina to New York State. Now, we will be following developments throughout the morning. Unlike this hurricane, the 5.8 earthquake that rattled the East Coast this week took everyone, even especially geologists, by surprise. And even when there are reasons to think that an earthquake could be just around the corner, scientists still have trouble making good predictions. 200 years have passed since the last major earthquakes rocked the New Madrid seismic zone. That's a fault system that runs down through the central U.S. through parts of Illinois, Missouri, Kentucky, Arkansas, and Tennessee. That quake was a magnitude 7.8. The region has had plenty of smaller quakes since then, but as St. Louis Public Radio's Veronique LaCapra reports, there is no clear answer to the question, when's the next big one coming?
The New Madrid earthquakes of the winter of 1811 to 1812 have become the stuff of legend. They were so powerful, the story goes, they made the Mississippi River run backwards.
It was what we call a thrust fault, and it came up to the surface beneath the river and actually created a stair step in the river bottom to where it set up waves that went coursing back upstream.
That's Susan Huff of the U.S. Geological Survey in Pasadena. She says much of what we know about those early quakes comes from firsthand accounts, like this one from future President Zachary Taylor. He felt the shaking 230 miles away in Louisville.
The sight was truly awful. Houses cracking, chimney falling, men, women, and children running in every direction in their shirts for safety. And a friend of mine was so much alarmed as to jump of a window and was very much hurt.
Huff's calculations put the largest New Madrid earthquake at about 7.0, the same magnitude as last year's earthquake in Haiti. The official USGS estimate is 7.7. The Federal Emergency Management Agency takes those numbers seriously, which is why this past May, the agency helped lead an earthquake drill involving 8 central U.S. states. At the Springfield Airport in Missouri, C-130 military airplanes revved up their engines, preparing to evacuate the injured. FEMA Regional Administrator Beth Freeman says the exercise was designed to test how the region would respond to a natural disaster on the scale of the original New Madrid quakes.
You know, back then there weren't very many people that lived in the New Madrid area, and today we have quite thriving populations of Memphis, St. Louis, and all those other communities in between. So if those earthquakes would reoccur, it could be quite devastating.
The problem is, scientists can't predict when, where, or even if another earthquake will happen. Seth Stein, for one, doesn't expect another big quake at New Madrid anytime soon. Stein is a geophysicist at Northwestern University. He and others have been using GPS technology to measure how the ground moves or deforms along active faults.
Now, normally the way earthquakes work is that you store up energy, the ground deforms before a big earthquake, kind of like stretching a spring, and then it snaps and you have an earthquake.
Stein says that warping of the ground has been measured in California, Alaska, Oregon, and Washington, along every fault where we think a big earthquake is on the way. So that's what he and his colleagues expected to see when they started taking those same kinds of GPS measurements at New Madrid.
And to our complete surprise, we see absolutely no motion of the ground.
Stein says part of the explanation could be that seismic zones in the middle of a continent seem to behave differently from those in places like California, where the huge plates that make up the Earth's surface thrust up against each other.
Faults in the middle of the continents will be active for short periods of time geologically, maybe a few thousand years, and then they'll turn off and be inactive for times, and then start up again. So it looks like we may be seeing the end of one of those cycles.
But many other geologists don't agree. Robert Williams of the USGS in Colorado says you can't ignore the past. The earthquakes 200 years ago liquefied the soil underground, blasting jets of wet sand out onto the surface.
There's been some great science done with geologists digging into these 1811, 1812 sand blows, and then lo and behold, discovering evidence for older sand blows caused by earthquakes of about the same magnitude as the 1811, 1812 sequence.
They realized that before 1811, there had been quakes in about 1450, and again before that, in 900. William says that pattern of very large earthquakes means another big one could be on the way.
We can't predict earthquakes, so the geologic record is really the strongest piece of evidence we have to remain concerned about earthquakes there in the New Madrid region.
So is there a risk or isn't there?
It's just difficult to be confident in places like the central U.S.
This spring, University of Washington seismologist John Vidali led an independent panel of experts who took yet another stab at evaluating the hazard at New Madrid. Yes, Vidali says, there are differences in the way fault zones in the middle of a continent behave. But...
yeah, given all the uncertainty, it's prudent to think what has happened in the past will continue.
And maybe next time, we'll be ready. For NPR News, I'm Veronique LaCapra in St. Louis.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
We take a leap now from the real to the fictional, but we're still staying at the Charlotte Motor Speedway.
A mauve dusk was yielding to thunderheads mounding like enormous eggplants. The evening was electric with the feel of an impending storm. The speedway was another Hatter's Tea Party of noise and turmoil. The sweaty, buggy air reeked of hot rubber, exhaust, sun-baked flesh, and fried food. Amplified announcements barely carried over the ear-splitting whine of engines screaming around a mile and a half of asphalt.
That's author and forensic anthropologist Kathy Reichs reading from her latest Temperance Brennan mystery, Flesh and Bones. You might be familiar with Temperance Brennan. Her adventures form the basis of the Fox TV series Bones. Brennan's latest case kicks off with the grisly discovery, a body stuffed in a drum full of asphalt, tossed into a landfill by the racetrack just as the biggest racing event of the year is about to start. And Kathy Reichs is with us now in our New York bureau to talk about her creation. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So you live in Charlotte.
I do.
A very big racing town. Can't really get away from NASCAR in Charlotte. And normally I would ask you something like, you know, why set your book at a racetrack? But actually what I want to ask you is, why did it take you so long?
Well, that's what my friends kept saying. I have some friends that are big fans and follow, or friends of the drivers and follow all the races. And every time I start a new book, they say, put it in, you know, put it in NASCAR. So they finally wore me down. And I'm glad. It was fun.
You say that you prefer to send Temperance to places that you're familiar with. But you weren't that familiar with NASCAR. What was that like?
I wasn't. I'm familiar with Charlotte, obviously. But I had to do a lot of research. So I contacted all of these people I know. I had contacted drivers and crew chiefs and owners and peppered them all with questions.
And you got a tour of the racetrack. You went and...
I did. I got a tour of the racetrack from Marcus Smith, who runs the Charlotte Motor Speedway. And I think the whole time he was trying to show me all the wonders of the track, I'm looking at this landfill next door saying, wait a minute, tell me about this dump, because I'm thinking this is a great place to put a body.
A body.
Yes.
And that's where the body ended up.
Exactly.
The book. What about Bones, the show Bones, which is based on your books, and CSI? You know, do you feel like there's so much criminal science that goes on in these cases that, and that's how they're solved, you know, is by some of this criminal. Does it give people a misleading idea of how a lot of these murders really are solved?
Yeah, not just murders. It's called the CSI effect. I just addressed the American Bar Association on this topic. The idea that jurors have way, way too high an expectation of science, that you're going to find that one scrap of skin in an acre of corn or something, and that's going to crack the case. And not only that, but I think there's also the CSI effects, if we want to call it that, impacts. I was just involved in the Casey Anthony case. And I think that also involves attorneys as well as expert witnesses in that expecting too much of science and pushing science way too far to the margins of where they should be presenting it in court.
What were you doing with the Casey Anthony case?
Well, I was the official forensic anthropologist on the defense team. I was reluctant initially, but I watched some of the media develop, and I was offended by how some of the media convicted this woman prior to her day in court, and that's not how our system is supposed to work. You're supposed to be convicted in court in front of a jury of your peers. So I did agree to, I did a full examination of the skeleton and visited the scene where the body was discovered.
When you're looking as a forensic anthropologist, when you go examine bones of something, what are you looking for? What exactly do you do?
When I'm brought into a case, usually at the request of a pathologist, and that's because the body's compromised. It's burned, mutilated, mummified, decomposed, dismembered, or it's just bones. For some reason, they need the forensic anthropology consult. It can vary what they want. It could be a question of ID. Who is it? If we have a completely unknown, I'll give them the age, the race, the sex, the height, any physical characteristics I can, so that the investigating officer can then match that profile against missing persons reports. Then we have a name. Then you can go out and get DNA or dental records or whatever, but you can't use those in a vacuum.
Did you get a lot of the details from this book and from most of your books from your actual work as an anthropologist?
Yes, I take ideas for my stories from either cases I've done or cases I've witnessed coming through our lab or our autopsy room, or maybe talking to colleagues attending professional meetings.
Did any of the storylines in Flesh and Bones come from real cases?
Well, we have done bodies in barrels in cement. Never done asphalt, but I figured, you know, I could figure that out. So,
and there was a lot in the book about how the body would decompose or not decompose because of the asphalt. And you had the hand was sticking up out of the
yes.
asphalt, so you could tell it was a body. Did you have to do a lot of research to figure
well,
out?
Well, actually, I saw cases of bodies in cement, and asphalt works pretty much the same. It's a pretty good sealant. It keeps you in there.
It's just like the character in this book was
exactly.
pretty much in the same solid state that he started in.
He or she. No spoilers.
That's right. Author and forensic anthropologist Kathy Reichs. Her latest book is Flesh and Bones. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll close this hour with an update to our top story. Hurricane Irene is passing through the Outer Banks of North Carolina, with bands of wind and rain stretching as far north as New Hampshire. At least 5 people have died, including a surfer catching waves from the storm in Florida. The hurricane's eye is expected to brush New York City around 8 a.m. tomorrow. Today, Mayor Michael Bloomberg joined a chorus of local and state leaders urging residents in low-lying and coastal areas to evacuate or stay inside.
Now, we've been saying this all day. The time is running out. The rains will start getting heavier, and then the winds will make it very difficult and dangerous to be outside.
And the best way to preserve human life on the Jersey Shore is for there to be no human beings on the Jersey Shore, given what's about to come.
Please stay inside. We've had reports of folks who are beginning to venture out. You endanger your safety and the safety of the first responders who might come to try to rescue you. Please stay inside.
That's North Carolina Governor Bev Perdue, and before that, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. You can continue to follow news and updates on Hurricane Irene throughout the evening at our website, npr.org. For Saturday, that's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan. We're back at this time tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening, and have a great night.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Victoria Jones is often sullen, silent, and hostile, but she speaks the language of flowers. She knows that red roses signify love. The primrose means childhood, which she never really had growing up in a series of foster homes and institutions in Northern California. The hawthorn means hope, which Victoria Jones ran out of after never being adopted, and then turned out of foster care and left on her own when she turned 18. Aging out of the foster care system convinces Victoria Jones to be suspicious of all attachments, signified by the Indian jasmine, by the way. She sleeps in the park and does odd jobs in a flower shop for small change until the power of flowers opens her life. The Language of Flowers is Vanessa Diffenbaugh's debut novel. It was the prize in a bidding war among publishers last year. It's now been published, and Vanessa Diffenbaugh joins us from WBUR in Boston. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Victoria Jones has a hard time trusting people, but, I mean, can you really blame her?
She absolutely has a hard time trusting people. And, you know, I've worked with foster kids a long time, and I think that this is something that foster kids and really all of us struggle with to some extent. If you've been hurt, as Victoria has many, many times, it's hard to learn how to trust again.
Does it help if youngsters can find something to cling to, like flowers, like horses, like baseball, like art?
I think for Victoria, it is a connection that she has with flowers, but I also think the other piece of that is it's just something she's good at. There aren't always, especially in low-income communities, the arts and the dance and the drama and the things that can really show a kid, look, even if I'm 3 years behind in math, there's something I'm good at that can help me be successful in life. And I think for Victoria, that's what the flowers give her, is a sense of success.
And as you note, you've worked with foster children. You and your husband are foster parents. So may we ask, to what degree is this novel drawn from real-life experiences close to you?
You know, the novel is 100% fiction, and as a novelist, you do draw on experiences or feelings that you have had. But Victoria, she's based somewhat on a specific young woman that I worked with. I was not her foster parent, but I did mentor her. And she had a very serious attachment disorder. She'd been born into the foster care system. She had a number on her birth certificate, and she didn't even know who named her. And there were brief moments when I felt that I knew her, and I loved her, and I knew that she was capable of loving me back, but I could never quite get through to her. And I really drew a lot on that experience of working with her when I was thinking about Victoria.
Victoria keeps going to different families. No one chooses to keep her until she meets Elizabeth. And I'm going to ask you to read a section from the book when Victoria is first introduced to Elizabeth. And the one thing Victoria knows is the rules.
You can't poison me or give me medicine I don't want or hit me, even if I deserve it. Those are the rules. I glared across the table when I said it and hoped she felt my threat. I had reported more than one person for spanking. If I were trying to poison you, I would give you foxglove or hydrangea, maybe an enemy, depending on how much pain I wanted you to feel and what message I was trying to communicate. Curiosity overcame my dislike of conversation. What are you talking about? These flowers are starwort, she said. Starwort means welcome. By giving you a bouquet of starwort, I'm welcoming you to my home, to my life. She twirled buttery pasta on her fork and looked into my eyes without a glimmer of humor. They look like daisies to me, I said, and I still think they're poisonous.
That's a kid who's really been hardened by experience.
Yes, she's very young in that section. She's only 9 years old. And kids are going to test you. And that's something that I think all good foster parents know going in, that it's not going to be easy. You know, in order, you have to really prove yourself to young people. And if you're answer is clear and consistent and loving, even if it's angry and disappointed. What's important is that you're being real and honest and not going anywhere.
Yeah, and without giving away too much of the plot, alas, it's one of those tests that pushes Victoria out of Elizabeth's arms.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you know as much about flowers as you do about foster families?
No, I don't. I love flowers. But, you know, I certainly sat down to write a book about foster care and to really try to tell the complexities of the emotional life of trying to learn someone, of trying to love someone who has never been loved and is learning to love you back. That was the story that interested me. I discovered the Language of Flowers at a very young age. And when I sat down to write this book, the first scene I wrote was the one in the flower market when Victoria sees a man who looks at her in a way that she doesn't like. And the next week, she brings him rhododendron, which means beware. And it wasn't premeditated. It was just that here was this young woman who was so hurt and so outside of society in every way, and she needed some way to connect and communicate, and the Language of Flowers was really what felt right.
You know, I think you explain this very well in the book, but let me try and get it explicitly in this form, too. A lot of people who haven't had the experience with foster children, with adopted children, will understand why do youngsters who hunger for love push people away?
If you've been given up at birth, if you've lost your own biological family, even if it was not your fault, even if your parents had addictions or ended up in jail, the fact that you don't have a family, I think, brings a lot of feelings of unworthiness. And so I think that the hardest thing about working with young people in foster care who've been through this kind of neglect and abuse is really to convince them that they are worthy of being loved. And I think because often they don't feel worthy of it, that's why they push people away.
Vanessa Diffenbaugh, her much-awaited debut novel, The Language of Flowers. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. stock market rallied yesterday after Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke offered an optimistic assessment about the country's long-term prospects for economic growth. Mr. Bernanke was speaking at an annual policy conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. He said despite the painfully slow recovery, the economy eventually will heal so long as policymakers take the necessary steps. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Think of the U.S. economy as a patient who's still bedridden after a long illness. This weekend's meeting in Wyoming is not just about how to get that patient up and hobbling around, but how to get him running wind sprints. The meeting's title is Achieving Maximum Long-Run Growth. Fed Chairman Bernanke says there's no reason to think the economy won't get up and running again, even if it's taking longer than anyone would like. He suggests Congress and the President need to do their part with additional programs to put people back to work. The problem is those programs cost money, and the government's already running a big deficit. Stephen Chiketty, who's chief economist for the Bank for International Settlements, warns too much government debt is like a weight on that economic runner.
What happens is that debt gets too big, and then if you're hit by another problem, you can't do anything about it.
So one of the challenges policymakers here are wrestling with is how to get control of the government's red ink without kicking the economy's wobbly legs out from under it. Maya McGinnis, who heads the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, echoed Bernanke, saying the government can deliver both long-term solvency and short-term economic stimulus.
If you put in a long-term plan, and usually we're talking about 10 years here, that gives you some fiscal space in the immediate time to do a little bit more to help the economy. And it also allows you to put some of those necessary reforms in the out years. We don't have to do them all this year or next year. That buys us a way to do the recovery in the short term, debt reduction in the long term.
President Obama is expected to make that same argument when he rolls out his jobs program early next month. Bernanke says the country's biggest long-term hurdles are not the recession or the rescue-driven jump in deficits, but an aging population, schools that leave too many students untrained, and a healthcare system that's both costly and inefficient. Harvard economist Catherine Baker presented a paper this weekend called Aspirin, Angioplasty, and Proton Beam Therapy. She says by focusing on smarter healthcare, we could save money and feel better, too.
We wanted to focus first on getting as much bang for the buck from our healthcare spending as we could, and then that will be useful in thinking through whether we're spending the right amount on healthcare given the cost of publicly financing it.
Fiscal watchdog McGinnis sees similar opportunities in reforming the tax code and shifting some federal spending into higher value programs. The goal, she says, is not just to cut the government's bottom line, but to do so in a way that makes the overall economy work better.
So you want to think about not just how do you save $4 trillion, but how you do it in a way that's consistent with growing the economy.
All of this made for some thoughtful conversation here in the picture postcard setting of Jackson Hole. But University of Chicago economist Austin Goolsbee, who just stepped down as one of President Obama's top advisors, is not sure how it will translate in Washington.
I think among many of the policymakers and economists, there is some agreement on ways to address that, but how that plays out in the political system, and especially in Washington, an environment, you know, we're going into the election, it's been very partisan. I don't think people were overly optimistic about that.
Bernanke notes this summer's drawn-out battle over raising the debt ceiling rattled financial markets and probably hurt the economy, too. Fever-driven politics may be one of the biggest factors keeping the economy from getting out of bed. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
In the Pacific Northwest, where a lot of people actually prefer to jog, run, and race themselves, not just watch professionals do it, there's one race that gets particular attention, a 197-mile, 30-hour relay race called the Hood to Coast. Christoph Baden created a film detailing the experience of four teams running the race. The film's called Hood to Coast, and in that film, Jim Ekberg, 23-year veteran and one of the runners, explains the race.
You start up 6,000 feet on Mount Hood. You come down into the countryside. You run from the valley to the city. From the city, you run out into the wilderness. In the wilderness, you run up onto the top of the Coast Range. Then you run down through this tidal estuary and all the way to the beach.
Well, Christoph Baden, the filmmaker, joins us from Portland, where today he's going to head up to Mount Hood and run his third Hood to Coast. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Baden.
No, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure.
So how do you get so many people to run their hearts out for 30 hours?
I think that's one of the mysteries we're trying to explore in the movie, because there really isn't any kind of prize money or different medals for people finishing this thing first. It's just for the love of, I think, of running, but more importantly, of camaraderie and just kind of being crazy and doing something truly extraordinary for yourself.
It's billed as the world's largest relay race, and I'm told that this year there's going to be 1,700 teams of 12 people.
It's basically imagined like a giant ant line of runners stretching from Mount Hood all the way to the coast.
And is that part of the appeal, or do sometimes all those people get in the way of someone who's really a runner?
One of the characters in the film described it best. He said, "This is Woodstock on wheels moving down the road for 200 miles. The running part of Hood to Coast, it's very tough, but that's something that's kind of easy to plan for. You just train a little bit. But the whole logistics part, that's part where it gets fun, and that whole camping aspect. You sleep in the field, you know, porter potty situation. So it really is. It is, think about it as a camping trip, but it's, you know, 17,000 people doing it at the same time.
But let me get this straight. There is some actual running involved.
There is, and it is actually very tough. I mean, you run between, your leg is between 4 and 8 miles, and you run three times. And that doesn't sound like much as a marathon, but because you have to, you know, travel down the road in basically a cramped minivan, your muscles just have enough time to really cram up, and you're going to be hurting on your third leg. And every marathoner we talk to said, this is a much tougher race than a marathon.
I'm told that people can, some runners can get just a little bit put out with runners who aren't of a certain caliber and kind of get in the way of other racers.
There's a term called roadkill, and this is actually a kind of a fun term. It's basically if you pass another runner, you accomplished a roadkill. And some runners keep track, and some people like that and others don't, but it's all in good fun. And, you know, one of the things why the elites are so great to have on this race course, it's kind of a little bit of a badge of honor to be road killed by one of those elite runners.
Christoph Baden, who's director of Hood to Coast, about the world's longest relay race, he's also going to be, I don't know, we don't say competitor, do we? Participant.
Participant is the right word, yep.
In this weekend's race. Thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely.